Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Before we get to the fun, here's a quick word from one of our sponsors.
Historically, we've been told use condiments sparingly because they're not good for you. We wanted a product where we could say use as much as you want. In fact, use more than you need because it's all good. And the more you put on your meal, the healthier the meal becomes.
Mark Sisson is the publisher of the popular health and fitness blog, MarksDailyApple.com, and the author of several best-selling books. And now, he's the creator of Primal Kitchen, a line of primal-inspired salad dressings and condiments.
The ingredients are avocado oil, and about 70% of the product is avocado oil, the healthiest of all oils, organic eggs and organic egg yolks from cage-free hens, vinegar, organic vinegar from non-GMO beets, and sea salt, and some rosemary extract. So it's a very simple list of ingredients. They're all very clean. They're all very healthful. And I think that appeals to a lot of people as well.
Right now, Thrive Market is giving away a free jar of Mark's avocado mayonnaise. If you're not yet a Thrive member, you'll pay just $1.95 in shipping. Existing Thrive members can also get a free jar of Primal Kitchen mayonnaise with your next order of $50 or more. Go to thrivemarket.com/wolfmayo.
Hi, folks. Rob Wolf here with another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Today's guest is someone that is one of my best friends, a mentor, the person that I tend to go to when I have a question. And like one of the ironies of my life is that the folks that I learn the most from, the folks that I am the closest to from a friendship standpoint, I tend to spend the least amount of time with them. Unfortunately, this man is Scotty Hagness. He is the founder of one of the first CrossFit gyms in the world, CrossFit Portland, and he has a laundry list of certifications and accomplishments, which we'll get to in just a moment. But Scotty, how are you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing great.
Awesome.
Good to talk to you finally.
Great to connect with you. You've been one of these people that I've, you know, it's like, okay, we really need to get Scotty on the show. But I, there was almost some anxiety and trepidation about doing it because I feel like I'm kind of repetitious on this stuff anyway. But I had this feeling that like your show would be the last show we ever did because basically every question would be answered. We just really wouldn't need another show. So I'm stoked to get you on here, but it probably won't be the last show. But
hopefully this isn't the end game.
we'll see. I mean, if it's really good, then I'm pulling the plug on it. We're just finishing on the highest note that we've had. Scotty, you have a really amazing background, both athletically and from a coaching perspective. Can you talk to folks about that, you know, going all the way from the trials bikes, you know, on up to what you're doing today, and talk about all the damn certs that you have, everything from like OPT to Poliquin, and I know another number of other avenues that you've explored as well.
Yeah, I'll try and touch on it a little bit. So very unathletic as a kid. I was a nerd, loved reading, which would pay off later on. But about 16, I got into BMX bikes, and that was early 80s, so kind of in their infancy. Really, really enjoyed that, the challenge of learning new skills constantly, and the fact that it was constantly evolving. There's constantly something new to do, kept me doing that for decades. And in fact, I still do it a little bit. We have a group of older guys that ride, and we still actually figure out how to do new stuff. And somewhere in that process, I got into bike trials as well, which is riding over obstacles, and did that for a few years and had pretty good competitive success doing that up to the world level briefly. And then really didn't do any training outside of riding my bike, which in hindsight, I realized gave me 15 to 20 hours of aerobic activity weekly for many, many years nonstop. But I started lifting weights about in the mid-90s, 96 or so. I started tinkering with my diet and getting into weight training as an effort to be able to ride longer, and found it really fascinating. And so that began my research and learning about 20 years ago now. Somewhere after a number of years, I realized, you know, wow, I kind of actually have learned a lot about this, and started doing some coaching just informally in clubs with some of the stuff we were experimenting with. And that led me to find a number of things real early on, like CrossFit in about 2002, I believe. And it was my search because I thought that gymnastic strength training might actually be better for the bike than a lot of barbell stuff, a little more specific. And the only thing I ever found was the original CrossFit side, and that was kind of where that all started. Certifications. I know we were trying to count one time how many weekend or even week-long courses I'd been to over the last 10 years or so, and we were at 60 and still thinking of them. So I've spent a lot of time.
Basically, you've
been
to all of them. Like if there was something offered, you've been to it.
That, yeah, pretty much. But some of the things that have been really influential, definitely the OPT certs. I was on the very first group doing the level one stuff, flying to Calgary five times in 1 year for that. And then all the level two things that he did originally, and just also as a personal mentor. I've done quite a bit of the Poliquin material. Early on, I was very into the movement disciplines. They're now becoming popular, but some of Scott Sawn and CST stuff in the early years, he was kind of really ahead of the game there. And then kind of through you, Ido Portal and I became friends, and he was here in town a fair amount. I've learned a lot from him over the years and various other sources, but I would say some of those folks are some of my main mentors. Nowadays, I kind of look into a lot of standard strength and conditioning kind of information, working with guys in town here like Mark McLaughlin and some of the circles that prepare high-level athletes. Is kind of my main interest these days.
Nice. And it's something that an unfortunate number of people are unaware of is that you've been doing a monthly column for the Performance Menu essentially since its inception, the Cooking with Scotty piece. And I believe you had probably the first paleo cookbook that also happened to be broken down into zone blocks in the world.
Yeah, I think that is the first one. I think 2007.
Yeah,
that
came out. 2006, 2007. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, covered the material from then, and yeah, that was. I did the 10-year column in the summer. I think it was August 2005 was the first time. Thanks to you that I did that, and little did I know that almost 800 recipes later, still be going.
I don't know if that's like a sincere gratitude or you're like, thanks, man, you basically gave me cancer. getting roped into that, but you've done an amazing job.
I would say raised my cortisol levels at times when I was late on a deadline, which definitely happens.
right. Shocker. So let's jump in. Like, there's so much stuff I want to talk to you about from nutrition to training and your own training, aerobic base, just a ton of different things, but how has your view of nutrition changed over the years? I know both you and I were very early in the kind of ketogenic intermittent fasting scene, but then you were also one of the first people to write a very thoughtful piece, basically making the case for the need for a higher carb approach to paleo. And how it explain that process. I think it'd be really interesting for folks.
Yeah. So I definitely was, kind of hit that whole ketogenic, the fasting thing real early on. I had tinkered with my diet a fair amount beforehand, kind of following more typical bodybuilding strength, athletic protocols. And when I first made the switch, I felt good. I was already fairly lean, but I got really lean in that first 6 months or so. And what I didn't really realize is that that kind of happened at the same time I was getting a lot of newbie gains from CrossFit. Now, I'd been lifting a long time, but, it was a completely different stimulus, so my performance seemed to be going up. But I definitely kind of stagnated after that, and I had issues that I later realized was, from thyroid issues and what was surely quite low testosterone. And those were some of the things that kind of piqued my interest as I started to look into things that control, that can regulate the levels of these other hormones. And I started to see some kind of clear patterns. And I had noticed that in other people that I was working with. And kind of looking into, some stress physiology and those areas kind of led me to start tinkering with adding carbs back in and seeing what would happen. I was at one point, I had a body temperature of like 94 point something routinely. Smokes. You know, it's freezing cold unless it was 90 degrees, which it is like 3 days a year here in the Pacific Northwest.
Right,
so
right.
I spent 362 days a year.
But you
freezing.
Would have been like a turtle. You would have probably lived to be like 300 years old, though.
Maybe.
just cold, tired, and low sex drive that whole 300 years.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. It was kind of an interesting thing. I had realized that the whole sex drive thing kind of fell off about the time that I started tinkering with my diet that way. And I kind of just chalked it up to, well, you know, I'm like getting close to 40-ish at that time. I never made the connection until later on. So I added carbs back in, a lot of tubers, went out of my way to find things besides sweet potatoes, and felt really a lot better. I slept better. Recovery was better. Yeah, got some sex drive back and thought all was well. But as I learned later on, I had a big threshold still to go, which kind of happened a few years later when, and it's a variety of things, being able to monitor my training load and not push myself over the edge, which I'm inclined to do if left to my own devices. But as I added in more sugar-based carbs, so a lot more fruits and things, and a little less protein and less fat for sure, and the change was just shocking almost. I mean, I felt like I was a teenager again, and it just continued for the last couple of years, really.
Now, give folks a little bit of a macro breakdown. Like, you, like how many grams of protein are we talking about? What's your height and weight? And then give folks kind of a bigger picture macro breakdown with where you are now.
Yeah, so right now I'm about 180. I'm 5'11". I'm eating around 3,000 calories a day, plus or minus, depending on the day. And then my protein, I think more in terms of grams-ish anymore, and I don't really do a lot more than about 120 or so, 120, 125, so lower than I have eaten since the 90s. Carbs, I'm probably at least 300 grams most days. That's definitely a bulk of my calories are coming from carbs. And fats are still, you know, they're still as much as 30%, so I'm not low fat by any means, but I just don't consciously add fat, really, and I don't seek out fatty cuts of meat. And then one other kind of interesting thing I'm doing at the moment is, for the first time in a very long time, is I'm eating very minimal red meat, based on some blood work I've had recently, and that's another topic we can chat on in a minute if you want. But so that's kind of what I do, and I don't know the exact percentages that necessarily would come out to, honestly.
But clearly quite different than when we were really mucking around with the ketogenic ratios. And I know we played around with, you know, really high protein to lower protein so that you could be in legit nutritional ketosis. Mm-hmm. I've always kind of leaned that way because it seemed to be the only way that I had some really consistent glycemic control. Like when I played with upping my carbs, I had like vision problems and all kinds of stuff. When you wrote up your experience in the performance menu about shifting to a higher carb intake, you had like a month and a half period of some kind of fat gain and a little bit of, you know, seemed like some metabolic shuffling, and then everything really, really hit a slipstream. Like, do you have any thoughts about what's going on with me? We've looked at small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, all kinds of stuff, and it haven't really come up with a ton.
Yeah, you know, I like to look at, I go with stress first, whether you know, where at any time I will occasionally have blood sugar disturbances, and I know always that it's something is going on. You know, my autonomic system is out of balance. That's where having that finger on your pulse of what is your HRV scores, or you know, what is your kind of baroreflex sensitivity, so basically like an orthostatic blood pressure type of a assessment. I look at those kind of things, and generally you're on one side or the other, or you've been on one side or the other for a while, and you can really dial in nutritionally even a little bit with knowing where you're at.
And remind folks about that orthostatic blood pressure. That's basically taking it while seated and then standing up and checking the delta between those.
Yeah, so it's generally going to be a supine lying is the first, and then you do a standing blood pressure, and you're looking at the change. Now, it's called the Raglan's sign or Raglan's test. And it's kind of a, you know, it's a crude, imperfect test, but you can definitely get some interesting results out of that. Generally, you're supposed to stay kind of, you know, 8 to 10 higher when you stand is good, but you'll see less than that, or you'll see an outright drop upon standing, and that showing lowered adrenal function. So you can kind of keep your finger on the pulse of, you know, what are your adrenals doing day to day or week to week. That's one I tend to go with more like a weekly measurement, unless I see it go sideways, and then I'm going to probably check it daily and see what changes.
Okay.
With that said, you can see, you'll find very little in the literature about having a very large increase. And I have a number of people that measure that for me routinely, and people that are in that sympathetic dominant adrenal driven state. I mean, they'll have 25, 30, you know, increase in pressure upon standing. So a really high spike. So that's something I really try to avoid, or we work on. And those folks that are in that type of a situation, you know, as far as changes in body composition, it is tough to impossible.
Right. Because they're just in that sympathetic dominant stress, fight or flight mode, and the body's mm-hmm. not going to want to turn much over under those circumstances.
Yeah, pretty much any extra calories at all, even still with some metabolic slowdown, they're going straight into storage probably.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how do you, let's just say I've got a friend who exhibits a lot of those characteristics. Clearly it's not me, but let's say it's a friend. It's like buying condoms, you know, like I'm buying this for a friend. Wait, what do you do to tackle that person? I had a podcast a week ago with a gal who does a lot of GAPS diet and some genetic testing and whatnot. And, you know, I've observed that if I get somewhere tropical, which means I'm on vacation and I get sun and I spearfish, you know, 80% of the day and all that, that my digestion is great. My carb tolerance is great. But I haven't really been able to replicate that when I'm a sedentary desk jockey trying to keep 15 different plates spinning. Like, what do you do for those folks in that case? Some meditation app, some constant low dose of opiate infusion. Like, what do you do with that?
Yeah, that is a tough question, but that is exactly what you see, and it really shows that it is coming from the stress side. So the first thing I'm going to do, if I identify that it is stress-based, whether that's just conversationally or we've actually tested some things out, I'm going to look at sleep, and that's got to be a first one. You know, how much, what times are you sleeping? If the sleep quality is poor, that's something else that's going to have to be addressed. Some other things I've used successfully, I have one guy, we use heart rate confluence apps. There's one called HeartMath. Basically where you're working on getting more parasympathetic through some kind of guided breathing. It's essentially a meditation. But I find the people that like technology and may have a real hard time, you know, sitting in the corner and meditating are totally happy to flip on their phone app and sit there and do it. So that actually works for a lot of people. There's a new one out. Elite HRV has the ability to do that as well. So it can assess your HRV in the morning. But then you can also use it as an app like this is another one. I think it's called Heart Rate Confluence. Aerobic work is another one. So a lot of these people have a very poor level of aerobic development, even if they're, you know, athletic otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
There's where that kind of lower intensity work is really good at shifting you more into a parasympathetic state. So we're going to do work to develop that. I between giving folks things like walks to do and then gym-based sessions that are like, you know, long, low intensity, but I rarely give someone, you know, go sit on the Airdyne for an hour. It's, you know, we make circuits where they're doing mobility work interspersed with several minutes of a standard, you know, monostructural activity.
Okay.
So that would be another thing. So
and are you do you have those folks wired up to a heart rate monitor and like what type of heart rate range are you gunning for folks? Like I know Phil Maffetone uses like 180 minus age to kind of mm-hmm. get a heart rate, you know, top end that you want to stay beneath, which for someone like me, that ends up being like 135, 145 beat per minute, you know, mm-hmm. max to be able to stay in that aerobic zone. That's kind of one question. Then I have this other question that, you know, so much of what we're trying to do with that on a metabolic substrate side is actually goosing fat mobilization. And so a lot of these folks are who are really pushing this aerobic base and developing that parasympathetic response are also very much leaning more towards this kind of ketotic fueled story. So maybe we could parse those out in two different pieces. Like, how are you establishing how you build that aerobic base steel? And then maybe the contrast that, you know, you've shifted towards clearly a higher carb intake, but a lot of these other folks are kind of advocating a higher fat intake, maybe even nutritional ketosis.
Yeah, so I do like the Maffetone formula. This is one I actually use the MAF test or variants of it just to kind of assess someone's general base aerobic abilities. But I'll give just sort of a range that is specific to that person, I feel. So it could be anywhere from 125 to 145 is generally. And usually the people I'm doing, individual programming for, they all will have a heart rate monitor because there's enough that we do with heart rate monitors or just even testing with them to make them useful. But once a person understands a feel for it, then it's pretty easy. You don't always have to wear one.
Mm-hmm.
But I find people coming, especially if they come from a high intensity training background, people have no idea what it's like to work at, 145.
Right, right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this is maybe a little bit of what you mentioned with the bike riding early on. Like, you just had baked into the cake hours a week of aerobic base development that was pretty low stress and a lot of fun. So, you could argue it was pretty restorative. For most of my life, I was coaching kickboxing and doing pretty active stuff. And I feel like I had a pretty good aerobic base. And then as good as CrossFit was for me in kind of exposing me to some new elements, my aperture of kind of movement options really constricted. Like, I didn't hike as much. I didn't do a lot of, I didn't do the kickboxing. My work became more and more sedentary. So it seemed like I was going from either sitting or standing doing cognitive work all day, and then I would go do a burner, and surprisingly I would be completely destroyed from that, and also trying to do Brazilian jiu-jitsu under a format like that. Yeah,
I think that some of the initial success was absolutely from that huge aerobic base that I didn't really even appreciate that I had. But having worn a heart rate monitor when I ride occasionally now, I was clearly in that just base aerobic development zone, and occasionally a little bit higher, but not a lot. A 90 minute was a short session, and I did that nearly every day of the week.
Hmm.
So, and then 3 and 4 hours was not uncommon.
Wow. Wow. So Scotty, talk a little bit about the fueling for that. And, Phil Maffetone, a number of folks, gosh, I'm blanking on his name, the guy from South Africa, Ted Noakes, a lot of these folks who are renowned endurance coaches, really into building an aerobic base, but they're tending to prescribe a higher fat intake. There was the a recent study by Finney and Volek where it showed that folks that are fat adapted, that are in nutritional ketosis, their fat mobilization was almost double what has been documented historically. Like, it literally required rewriting the textbooks. What are your thoughts on that? Like, the one thing that I haven't seen come out of that, it's kind of like, okay, these folks are mobilizing more fat. Maybe this would be a really good argument for someone who is, say, like an ultra endurance athlete or something along that line. But I'm not seeing folks say, okay, I did this course, with this time, and then I became fat adapted and I did the course on less time. Like, these folks are definitely mobilizing more fat. They're using fat as a primary fuel source, but I'm not seeing them say very consistently that they're doing these things necessarily faster or dramatically faster. Like, what are your thoughts on the fueling, particularly since you've shifted away from that more ketone driven metabolism?
Yeah. Sitting here nodding my head, actually. Yeah. That is my observation feeling is that if you are indeed an ultra endurance athlete that's going to work at very low intensities but for many, many hours, there may be some, those really still relatively unproven benefit to that as far as, from a pure performance standpoint. But very few people are doing that. Certainly from a health perspective, we're not doing that. And for pretty much any athlete that isn't an extreme endurance athlete, you're going to be using you're going to be using glycogen, whether it's in slow glycolysis or what. And so I think more in terms of reducing the stress on the body, which there is definitely a stressor in not having topped off glycogen stores. And even if you're going at a marathon pace, you're going through your glycogen, regardless of how fat adapted you are. And so trying to get the body back to a restorative state, drop stress hormones as soon as we can after training and at all other times during the day as much as possible, I see giving that a better recovery and not impairing endurance performance at all. And particularly in folks who ultimately want to be great at, you know, a 20-minute event, if they're like CrossFit competitors, you know, you really, you need to have the glycolytic processes working well.
Right.
Certainly aerobic-based, but you're going to use the sugars. There's no way you're not.
Right, so, I was even reading some Phil Maffetone stuff. I guess yesterday, when you have kids and you're getting ready for the holidays, you're kind of like, was that a month ago?
Right.
It was actually a day ago, but I was reading some of Maffetone stuff. And when he's in that aerobic base building period, he makes the point that if you pop the intensity up too much, and again, this is, and we'll probably talk about some block periodization here in a bit, but one way that you can tell if you got that aerobic base training session done properly at the end of it, you should feel good, should have, you know, a little bit of euphoria to it, but there shouldn't be a really strong desire for carbs specifically, because you didn't necessarily super deplete your glycogen stores, and therefore you didn't impact that stress response. I'm thinking like 50 different things here, and I almost want to like pause and take a bunch of notes and pop this thing back on. So Mike Ruscio and I have talked a ton about this stuff, and you know, gut dysbiosis. There's so much understanding now that the gut microbiome ends up playing a huge impact on health. But you know, it's been a little challenging for me to unpack exactly what's going on there, because we know that. You know, if you have one group of folks that have what we call good gut bacteria and a group of folks that have bad gut bacteria, you can cross-populate those two people, take the bad and stick it in the good, stick it in the bad, and you can, you know, basically goose those folks towards a different health outcome. But we also know that just one night of missed sleep or poor sleep negatively alters gut microbiota. It shifts it towards kind of a what we call a pathogenic profile. Don't want to put words in your mouth, and I don't want to jabber inanely because you're the smart guy on this conversation, not me. But could you make an argument that the stress component is the bigger story here, like the allostatic load is the bigger story relative to like the gut dysbiosis and all that type of stuff? Like if you just really get that stress piece dealt with, that probably these things that were typically characterizing as gut dysbiosis and glycemic, you know, control issues, that it's really an allostatic load issue versus, you know, bacterial overgrowth, that the bacterial overgrowth may be a symptom and not a cause specifically.
Yeah, that's really my feelings exactly. You know, take me a long time to come around to that, but I think that's a symptom, a downstream effect of that allostatic load and what you're under. And if you're subjected to more than you can recover from, one of the first places we see that manifest is in the gut. You know, we know that having proper parasympathetic tone is very important in keeping the inflammatory process down. There's some interesting new research on that I just read as well. So if you're, again, in a sympathetic dominant state, inflammation is going to be higher, and the gut is one of the first places that you're going to see that manifest, though that same inflammation is going to give you that kind of fatigue feeling in the brain. It's kind of that break on the whole system, trying to slow things down. But generally what I've noticed is you see gut and digestive issues in people that have chronically eaten too little, which is a lot of people in my experience, frankly, have overtrained. So both those are major stressors, or people who are just under so much of a workload. Yeah, there's no restorative time. Same thing. Lack of sleep. Same thing. But if you fix those things, the gut is much better. You can tolerate foods you wouldn't otherwise tolerate. It's kind of right back to your kind of vacation example. And, you know, I think you and I and others have probably known countless people that tell that story. You know, I went on vacation and, you know.
I ate tacos and drank margaritas the whole time, and I came back leaner, and then, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. I'm thinking like 50 different things here. So, Scotty, how once you've got somebody kind of buttoned up on dealing with the allostatic load via the monitoring and building, or you know what, how long are you building an aerobic base for somebody? And I assume that that's probably kind of contingent on what type of athlete they are. But let's say we're talking about kind of a CrossFitter or maybe a MMA or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu athlete. Like, how long are you spending in building that aerobic base, weeks, months, before we start peppering in a little bit of a specific glycolytic training? You know, so the typically the longest sessions that I do in a round is about 5 minutes. Sometimes we'll do 10-minute rounds, but you know, even if I go to competition in jiu-jitsu, they're 5-minute rounds, so I'm going to want to time index the bulk of my stuff right around that. But how long am I building that aerobic base, and what type of like HRV scores, heart, resting heart rate and stuff like that am I looking at before I shift gears and start doing some glycolytic work?
Yeah, a good question. And of course, as always, it depends.
Right.
Depends on how long you have. You know, what's the time frame to something that where you're trying to perform well, be it a competition or whatever. You have multiple years, it can take a really long time. It's something you can work on developing for quite a while. But the volume of work, if you're trying to increase left ventricle hypertrophy, increase cardiac output, if that's what you're attempting to do to kind of build the base engine bigger, it takes an investment of a lot of time. And I think that's why some folks have tried to do that, say in CrossFit or other areas. And, you know, they'll add in these, you know, 30, 40, 60 minute, you know, Z1 sessions. And they don't see a lot of benefit. And it's, they just haven't physically done enough work. It takes a number of hours a week just to see like a 20% increase over time. So it can definitely be a bit time consuming. But I try to go with, you know, at least a few months of that to see some definite improvement. And like anything, like for you, it would probably take a while because you've been consistently training for many, many, many years, as opposed to someone that's maybe relatively new. I may see, you know, some pretty significant increases in just a few months of work. As far as testing that, we can do it a number of ways. We can look at, say, the MAF score on the MAF test, like you mentioned earlier. Like, I usually use a 30-minute aerodyne at a set heart rate. But you can also look at HRV scores and resting heart rate. And those, again, also you have to be a little cautious of, because just because you have a high HRV, that would make you appear that you had good aerobic ability, and a low resting heart rate, there's people that are in a very metabolically kind of shut down state that will exhibit those things where they're kind of stuck in a parasympathetic mode. I know at least one person that had a resting heart rate that looked like a pretty good endurance athlete, yet did no endurance training whatsoever. And it was just from metabolic slowdown from under eating, under fueling, under recovery. So you have to be really cautious. And then that's where the orthostatic blood pressure test that we talked about earlier comes into play, because that person will exhibit a very large fall in blood pressure upon standing. And then you realize, oh, that's not what we want to see on the HRV. But generally, you want to see the resting heart rate come down and HRV scores up. Depending on what score you use, unfortunately, there's not really a real standard, but one that people are familiar with, like the BioForce or the iFelite, would be around a 70 and up.
Okay.
Is something you'd want to see.
Okay. I'm taking notes on this stuff too. So sorry to you and to the listeners, because I'm taking some notes on this. So you mentioned that you structure some of this low level aerobic base with some kind of aerobic circuits. Like, you know, I'm working out mainly in my home garage. I have a Concept 2 rower, an aerodyne, and a VersaClimber. And then, you know, I can do jump rope and do all kinds of other stuff. Like, how would you break up, you know, time on each one of those elements? Like, I've been doing, say, like 10 minutes on each one of the the monostructural guys, and then you know, just rotating through. And so I'll get 30 to 60 minutes a whack doing that. What you're saying is probably right on the ass end of actually even being effective. I try to get multiple sessions like that a week, but is that a good time indexing? I haven't really been mixing other, say, like calisthenic movements or anything in with that. Like, how would you improve that to help build this aerobic base?
Yeah, so it doesn't necessarily have to be a really long session. It's the total accumulated volume over the week. So you could do more than one session in a day if you wanted. The nice thing is they don't really require warm-up or cool-down. You can just go in and do it. As far as keeping it interesting, I go with a little bit the person's what they enjoy, or if they have a lot of mobility issues, and we can work on that at the same time. So it could be something like 5 minutes on each modality, and every time you rotate modalities, you're going to do 1 minute of some sort of a dynamic mobility movement. So, I mean, you know, there's hundreds that you can pick from, but it may be some, maybe you do, you know, like long Cossack switches, or you do, you know, some sort of flow work if you have some, you know, flows you can do.
Right.
Yeah, if you have background there, you can do it. That's one way to do it. Other times, another way I'll do it sometimes is I'll give someone a long block on one modality, or maybe they only have one modality, say every 5 minutes or every 10 minutes, get off and do, you know, X number of gymnastic skills. You know, they, that really allows them to kind of work on what they feel like that day. It's low intensity. They're still moving. Their heart rate's still staying in the range, and they're getting back on, kind of breaks it up. And then another fun one is around the world training. If you have four modalities like you do, you could just rotate every minute on the minute. So you're on one for a minute, hop on the one next minute. That keeps it kind of interesting, and you know, you can add in running or different things in there too.
Okay. I've done a little bit of that. Like, I've done almost kind of a fight gone bad structure, but I keep the pacing aerobic. Like, it can be conversational, but I'm going from like aerodyne to rower to VersaClimber to jump rope, and then I'll do some. Usually some sort of a jujitsu type movement. Like, I have a heavy bag on the floor, and I'll go from knee on belly back and forth three times, and then a couple of elbow and you know, hammer fist strikes, and then back and forth, and basically a minute each one of those, but never really dipping into the glycolytic kind of realm. Would you keep that 1 minute break in, you know, at the end of that 5 minute deal, or just keep that thing like a nice slow continuous pace?
I think either can work. I usually tend to go with a continuous, but if you're staying in that heart rate, you know, 1 minute's not really going to take you out of it. And some people appreciate that 1 minute rest. And I mean, you know, the more naturally explosive or anaerobic a person is, they tend to like those pauses. So
right.
I think that
right.
probably applies in your case, I think.
Right. Yeah, so should I avoid that then, or force myself to stay more?
I would
even
go
keeled?
With your nature a little more. Okay. One thing I always try to think about is what is this person's natural, what is their natural inclination, and you're going to produce less stress hormones doing things that work with your nature than you are. So, you know, a very gifted strength athlete may absolutely need to do some aerobic work, but too much of it is going to be much more stressful than someone who's more naturally on the endurance side, like myself. It's like, oh, cool, I'll do that, you know, and I can't tolerate as much as the other.
Gotcha.
So.
Okay. This is a little bit more, I guess, biomechanics oriented, but I've noticed that a lot of these monostructural elements, the rower, the aerodyne, even the VersaClimber, oddly enough, I thought it would be a little more glute and hamstring active, but it seems like all this stuff is very quad dominant. Are you seeing a lot of hip flexor issues with them? Too much aerodyne, bicycling, rowing. It seems like you know, hill walking or treadmill walking at an incline or sled drags are about the only way that you're getting like some posterior chain activation in that. Like, how are you addressing that from kind of a biomechanic balance?
Yeah, that potentially could be. Potentially a problem, and those aren't, you know, bad things to throw in the mix if you have access to them. The VersaClimber, although I love it, is surprisingly on the quad side. I, you know, almost always conclude sessions nowadays with various breathing drills. That tip being tight is a symptom of poor core stabilization and breathing patterns, really, now, in my estimation, more so.
Mm-hmm.
And doing some drills to kind of activate the diaphragm also rebalances the nervous system, but I find now you don't have to do a ton of stretching to release that hip flexor. In fact, that's not always the best strategy.
Okay.
I find as far as, you know, as long as you're doing some posterior chain work in the strength training side, you know, you're going to be, I think, okay there.
Okay.
And then remembering this should be a phase, and that other times, you know, you're going to be doing a lot less of the aerobic work.
So when do you, again, I'm sure it's highly dependent on what the person is up to. You know, for me, I really don't have any aspirations for competing in jiu-jitsu. I just kind of like to go to class and not feel completely smashed afterwards, to have a decent gas tank for doing the training that I want to do at that time. If I don't have a specific peaking cycle that I'm looking at, how would you tackle that? Do I just keep building that aerobic base till the cows come home, and rely mainly on the sportive activity to supply some of that sports specific glycolytic training, or, you know, how long do I ride that aerobic base pony before shifting some gears on that?
Yeah, so I'd pick a time that's a little ways out. So in your case, maybe you would do 2 to 3 months of kind of aerobic base work, and then you'd work through a phase where you would bring the intensity up. And I really kind of look at trying to do as much aerobically as possible, even for CrossFit athletes now.
Right.
We try to work on the alactic anaerobic side and the aerobic side, and not really do a lot of work in the glycolytic side. Now, there are rare cases where someone needs to learn to produce power, you know, we'll go there. But having that ability will allow your work in that glycolytic pathway to be much better, and you'll recover much faster. So the next thing I would do after that phase is I'd kind of work into some threshold work where you're going at, you know, controlled heart rates again, but what we would estimate being kind of around an anaerobic threshold, and work block at that. You can start adding in some more specific stuff, so some different drills, or it can be monostructural. Again, I try to mix it up. Like in the sport of CrossFit, what I would typically do is at first start people with just monostructural efforts in that range, but then moving into mixed circuits where we're doing some of the lighter movements for reps. Again, that can be done without throwing the person out of that zone we're trying to get into, and it helps teach pacing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then recently been playing with a little where we'll intentionally do a short piece of it where it spikes lactate a bit. So this can either be a harder effort of a monostructural, say like 400 meters at a higher pace, and then maybe at first 1,000 at a slower pace, which allows you to recover and trains the system to use that lactate produced better. So a circuit like that I was personally doing yesterday was like, box jumps and wall balls for a little bit, and then I went out on a run and I worked to get my heart rate down to a certain level, and then speed up as I can maintain that. So and then the runs actually get faster over time, and you're able to absorb and use that lactate better.
Mm-hmm.
Then the final piece would be, I would do a small amount of, I really think of them more as like cardiac power intervals, where you're actually trying to develop strength of the heart muscle and train the heart muscle. Toward the end, and these would be circuits of, they can be a couple minutes up to about 5 minutes, and they're pretty much like full out maximal effort with like one-to-one rest.
Mm.
And then a longer rest. And these are built right. These are really horrible, but you only need to do a very small amount of them. The residual of the training effect can last quite a while. And the fatigue curve, you know, if you're actually monitoring, you'll see it pretty promptly. So it really only takes a small amount. I'll tend to do 1 week, two sessions in 1 week, a week off, two sessions in another week, and then 1 to 2 weeks off before whatever event or test or just end of the phase. And there's little bit of research shows how long the residuals will last on that, and that further training that ability doesn't actually give you much improvement beyond that.
I remember reading an article that you had, and then also just the super compensation phase, like you've got to ding that bell and wait for everything to recover, and then the recovery part is where then you want that competition phase to occur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah, and having just a clear difference in going into something recovered and ready and being able to push, you know, anytime you're in the middle and it's just you're in the suck, it's, you know, especially if you've just started, you know, you weren't fully recovered to do that.
Right. Scotty, I saw this in our gym, like we were taking folks that both had an inadequate strength base, but oftentimes also an inadequate aerobic base. And you know, we'd fry them, we'd put too much intensity on them. I see this a ton in the Brazilian jiu-jitsu scene too. Like jits typically is a pretty glycolytic sport, particularly if you've got a reasonably competition-oriented kind of frisky population of folks. I've really been trying to steer our training at our school and just the training that I do more in that aerobic, you know, base kind of realm. And so we use drills and flow rolling and stuff like that. Like how, does that sound right? I mean, it's just so hard to get people and coaches to dial that intensity down and build volume over time, keep people more aerobic in their sportive activity. A lot of folks, the only exercise that they do is say like that 3 days a week of jiu-jitsu or something like that. Like that is their time to train. A lot of people kind of look down their nose at that. It's not, you know, it's not hard enough. What are your thoughts around all that?
Yeah, we have kind of a, you know, no pain, no gain culture. And there's definitely people that are a little loath to not work at absolute max intensity. You know, one thing we do a lot here is build just rate limiters into the workout in some way that kind of makes it hard to go at that level, whether it's either enforced rest or you're doing, you know, on something on a pace, or just the movements themselves lend themselves to, yeah, you know, you can't go that fast. Mm-hmm. That's one way to do it. And then just education. I mean, a lot of people that come to me now kind of know that, you know, I take a long view approach of training. So I don't have to do as much, but there's definitely a phase that you have to go through with folks to explain why this is going to benefit. And if they can understand, you know, physiologically what you're trying to do. But, you know, in group classes, especially if it's, you know, different people coming and going, that can be difficult
super
to do.
Challenging. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Sometimes we like to do the things that aren't the best for us, unfortunately.
Shocker. Yeah. Well, it's definitely been an uphill battle to sell this idea of like a drills and skills class where we could get in and you know, work positional sparring. If you have a disparity in weight or technicality for the person who's heavier or more technical, to dial back the input that they're giving so that the person drilling it is both successful but also getting a decent level of work output but not totally smoking themselves and getting them out of that fight or flight response. And it's been a tough deal. I've found that I have to do the bulk of my training on my own if I want to try to emulate something like that.
Yeah, I could definitely see that being being a problem. But hopefully over time, you know, I think as more and more people look to ways of monitoring themselves, as the quantified self movement probably continues to grow, people will realize the impact that some of the things they're doing have on them. And the cat will be out of the bag, so to speak, but it may be a long time before we see that.
Right. Hey, speaking of long time, like you've done a ton of different things with kind of an eye towards health and longevity. You're not a small guy, but you've had planches, planche push-ups, front levers, back levers, some pretty impressive gymnastics skills. What are you doing, and what are your thoughts on this kind of long-term approach. I know that more recently you kind of got into a little bit of a bodybuilding kind of phase, a little more barbell oriented. Like, what are your thoughts on kind of, you know, the ultimate skinning of performance, health, and longevity? Like a little smattering of gymnastics body weight stuff with a decent amount of barbell volume to keep some muscle mass and neural integration going. Like, how are you looking at all that?
I do really enjoy the gymnastic movements. I haven't done them a lot lately, and that's just every few years my focus tends to change. I think keeps it interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I'll cycle back around to them, but I like using gymnastic based progressions for upper body work, not exclusively, but I think that's probably better from a health and longevity perspective once someone has good range of motion, good control, especially of, you know, the scapula, etc. And the lower body, you know, it's hard to load it well enough, just purely body weight. I mean, yes, there's definitely some challenging pistol variants you can do, and those are great to work on if you wish, but I think you still have to pick up heavy things, or at least reasonably heavy things. And I think more kind of a bodybuilding type of a style of training is not a bad idea for health and longevity, for sure. I mean, not the volumes, not all the isolation movements necessarily, but just kind of the idea of the time under tension, maybe using set tempos to produce certain responses that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. That can be really beneficial for folks. And the longer time under tension, better, you know, joint conditioning, joint strength. With the gymnastic stuff, you know, it's interesting now seeing that that's actually kind of catching on, and different methods kind of coming around to training it. One thing I've seen is people that are already really strong and have been doing training for a number of years, spending in what seems to be an inordinate amount of time on some of the super basic skills that they're clearly beyond. And that's where, you know, I've had conversations with folks about, you know, let's look at the bigger picture here. You know, that maybe you don't need to follow this exact set routine,
right,
if you're not starting from square one, and understanding that this is designed for someone starting from square one, possibly.
Yeah, I have a good friend of mine, Patrick, who a pretty big dude, 215 pounds, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, pretty damn strong. And he was hung up for like a year at the 5 1-minute rounds of, you know, lock-offs, you know. Yeah. I was talking to him, I'm like, you know, I think that you could probably skip that one. Like, he had like 3 or 4 5-minute rounds, but he is super literal, just like dot the I, cross the T kind of thing. And I'm like, I will give you permission to bypass that for a while and, you know, see how you do. And so he did. And I think he's pretty stoked with going with that. But, you know, you on the one hand, you do want to do honor to the, you know, the programming and the structure that's been put into place. But then at the same time, you know, it's kind of like, okay, 120-pound person doing 5 1-minute rounds of lock-offs is probably not a big deal. 215-pound person, totally different story.
Yeah, I saw that same, that exact same progression, actually, waylay some people, and same thing, just people that spent months on that, you know, kind of literal guys and bigger dudes usually.
Right.
But yeah.
Interesting. So Scotty, you're making a bid for the Masters CrossFit Games here in about a year and a half. Tell folks about that.
Well, I mean, I'm not the most gifted of athletes by any means. I appreciate that though, because it makes me study and learn and try different things. But we'll see. You know, I entered my first CrossFit competition in 2004, which most people probably don't even know there were competitions right. back in 2004. But the CrossFit Championships, which preceded the games in Seattle, and have entered on and off, you know, for a number of years. And I just find the sport fun. I don't like doing WODs all the time, and so I do very structured training, but I enjoy testing myself now and then, and the complexities of preparing for the sport are, I think, really interest me. So I've been on kind of a 4-ish year plan till I turn 50, and just developing the pieces and working on skills and, you know, just kind of having fun with it. And And so that's kind of where I'm at.
So you've got a 4-year plan on it. Okay.
Yeah. Well, wow. It had even been longer than that, but I kind of built an Olympic cycle, so to speak.
Right.
And I figured to bring up some of the things where I might need them to be, might take that long. So aerobically, that side seems pretty solid. Got some work in some other areas and some skills that I've neglected. Some skills I've done forever in a day, you know. Others I've kind of neglected working on as much as I should have. I've always been pretty good at handstand push-ups, and I realized you have to be good at kipping them. And thankfully that I got that down really fast, but other things, not so fast.
Right. What about the Olympic lifts? Where are you on the Ole lifts?
Yeah, those are always kind of a bit of a bugaboo. And, the one area that I've always struggled with is my elbow issues from the riding. And while those are far better than they used to be, they do cause some problems with the O-lifts and locking out. And somehow they haven't seemed to be such a problem with the body weight skills, but in O-lifts and things like that, they definitely have. So
interesting.
Coming along, but not nearly like I would like.
I forget who it was, somebody observed that they just don't see many people make master of sport in kettlebell lifting unless they get into the sport pretty early, because you need so much mobility and perfect orthopedic placement to be able to rest and make the whole thing efficient. Mm-hmm. And, it kind of makes me think about that in a way where if you've accumulated some, desk jockey stuff and some, thoracic impingement or issues, that it definitely makes a ton of the overhead positions, whether it's kettlebells or Olympic lifting, a lot more challenging and I think potentially a lot more orthopedically impactful, because you're just not carrying things in the nice lines and the planes that would be ideal for maximal loading and some good longevity on that.
Yeah, I see that. And I think that's something that I'm personally battling a little bit too, because my job has actually turned into more of a desk job. I write training programs for people all the time now. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, I don't teach many classes at all, and I don't have all that many one-on-one clients that I see on a, weekly basis. So I'm sitting behind a computer, and undoubtedly, getting laptop smartphone syndrome going.
Right.
And though I've always had good overhead mobility with my shoulders, the fact that the elbows don't completely lock out kind of negates some of that.
Right. You just need to do some jujitsu and have somebody really break that elbow. Just
crank
like, really hyperextend that baby, and you'll probably be good. I mean, might limit your training for a little while, but it'll fix that orthopedic.
Well, I'm straight arms, but yeah.
Totally. They just don't bend anymore, actually, because we snap the bicep tendon. So,
yeah.
Well, Scotty, it's been fantastic having you on the show. I apologize for taking so long to do this. You are one of my dearest friends. I hope folks get a little bit of an appreciation for the depth and breadth of your knowledge. Like, you literally are the guy that when I've got a question about something, I go to you, and you've got a incredibly credible answer. And if you don't know, then you at least have some good theory about what the heck the answer to a question is. So it's been awesome having you on the show.
Oh yeah, I certainly appreciate it.
Scotty, where do folks track you down on the interwebs, or are you trying to hide and you don't want them to track you down?
I'm trying to write and do things a little more lately. So you can find me at the gym site, crossfitportland.com, of course. And then on Facebook, I mainly just share and write there a little bit. But those would be the two places right now.
Okay. We'll get links to that in the show notes. Scotty, great chatting with you. Happy holidays, and thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely, Rob. Thanks for having me, and happy holidays to you guys too.
Okay. We'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thanks again for listening to the Paleo Solution Podcast. Here's a quick message from one of our sponsors.
You
you know, the true definition of sleep, circuitous, it's the lack of wakefulness, right? And you have to allow the wakefulness promoting hormones and neurotransmitters to go away. And it's in our language, you drift off to sleep, you fall to sleep, you slide into sleep, right? You don't push a button and go, I'm on to sleep now. Like, it doesn't work that way.
That's Dr. Kirk Parsley, sleep expert and former Navy SEAL. And Doc Parsley wasn't just a SEAL. He was also the physician for the SEALs. He created the Sleep Cocktail product after years of working with SEALs suffering from chronic sleep issues. How does the Sleep Cocktail work? Let's let Doc Parsley tell us.
All my supplement does is it truly supplements, or it just supplements all of the substrates along the melatonin pathway. Gives you a really, really low dose of melatonin just to kickstart it off. So you're getting just a dusting of melatonin that's just enough to kind of help you initiate the cascade. And then I talked a little bit about GABA increasing as you go to sleep and kind of slowing down the neocortex. So there's a form of GABA in there, GABA derivative called PH-GABA, that really is just a way to get GABA to cross the blood-brain barrier so that it can actually work in the brain and the body. And that's it. I mean, that's it.
Give Doc Parsley's sleep cocktail a try. Go to robwolf.com/sleepcocktail and use code ROBWOLF10 to save 10%.